It is the early hours of the morning, and a group of Austrasians are gathered together in a war council. The silence of dawn is suddenly broken by the clangs of bouncing metal, as a guard sprints to the door of the tent, his armor gleaming golden with the morning sun. "Sir," he shouts. "Sir, I have spotted a forest approaching our position." "A forest? What do you mean?" The captain responds. "It's the woods, sir. The trees seem to be moving towards us." At this, the guard was laughed out of the room, as the men went back to their battle preparations, not noticing the abundance of new horses on the horizon. With the blow of a horn, the trees just over the hill dropped their branches, and behind them sprang thousands of well-armed men, Neustrians, here to stop the Austrasian advance on their homeland of Soissons. As the severity of the situation dawned on the men, they faced a choice to either escape the slaughter before it was too late, or stand and fight, dying an honorable death in the midst of this dishonorable war of brothers. In doing so, they would mirror the doomed soldiers of Macbeth, springing from the mind of an inspired Shakespeare over 1,000 years later. Much like Macbeth, the kings of the Franks would find themselves in increasingly complicated and brutal situations, following the vortex of pride and ambition that came with being so close to the royal throne they knew that they deserved. This throne was not that of Scotland, however. It was the combined thrones of Austrasia, Neustria, Aquitaine, Burgundy, and the German tributaries. King of all the Franks. Welcome back to Between the Seas. Last time, we went over the life and times of the Avar Confederation, which occupied Pannonia for the 250 years prior to the late 700s. Today, we will do the same for the other great power of inner Europe during this first Dark Age, the Franks. When we last talked about the Franks, we went over their origins and how they stood apart from the other Germanic conquerors that came with the fall of Rome. They were the first tribes to unlock the potential that came with uniting the Germanic and Latin civilizations, which they did through adoption of Catholicism and the establishment of Salic law, wherein Germanic Franks and their warrior aristocracy would handle political leadership and the military, while the largely Gallo-Latin church would handle small-scale administration and social cohesion. Tying it all together would be the strong hand of the Merovingians, with their special hereditary place as the ruling dynasty. They would travel the vast realm with their elite retinues, their military forces combining the heavier equipment of Rome with the offensive tactics and ferocity of the Germanics, and their mobility enabled by their newfound appreciation of mounted cavalry. This order would form the foundation for the earlier Franks, but would change significantly over the generations and generations of Frankish civilization. So let's go into how the Franks would change in the hundreds of years after Clovis, and go over some of the dramatic events that define their family squabbles. Clovis would serve as the legendary founder of Frankish greatness. As often happens with these breakthrough moments of immense change in history, the precedents set by Clovis during his life would become invaluable sources of legitimacy for his successors. This legitimacy would be shackled with some major rites of passage, however. The main driver of conflict during this time would be the Frankish succession laws, set both by the precedent of Germanic tradition and by the legendary founder of Clovis himself. Upon his death, Clovis would divide his massive realm into four chunks for each of his surviving male heirs. Although Germanic precedents may have been enough to spur this action, Clovis may have decided to do this for other reasons as well. For one, despite the Catholic Church endorsing monogamy, Germanic leaders under Salian law were allowed and even encouraged to practice polygamy. Due to this, there was often pressure for children of different families to be included in the succession plans. Clovis provided an example of such a case, with one of his heirs being of a different mother than the other three. Of course, the main drawback with this succession plan, besides dividing the maximum possible potential of the state, was that it encouraged the sons to fight over their father's legacy. A united realm and the full legitimacy of Clovis could therefore only be reached through bloody fratricidal wars of unification. This may have not been an unintended effect of the plan, though, as it was seen by the Germanic culture as a way to encourage powerful and competent leaders to be the only ones who could successfully rule a united realm. Seeing it through this lens, sure, the Germanic elite would give up a lot of authority to the Merovingian leader, but this leader would have to be one worthy to follow, someone tested by battle who had already earned the respect of their people. With these vague concepts, Clovis would die in 511, and from this sport, his sons would begin the very real and very brutal wars which were implied. Before we get further into breaking down the significance and changes of Frankish society over the 6th, 7th, and 8th centuries, let's go over this first round of the carefully crafted unification game, as it will provide some much-needed context. This round of the games would begin with a bit of familial solidarity. Three sons were of the same mother, a Burgundian, and she would ask them to seek vengeance for her family, who had been overthrown in a coup back in Burgundy while she was away in Frankish court. The three sons would oblige, first seeking revenge and then conquest of the Burgundian lands. The conquests would bring in their half-brother, though one son would fall in battle and be decapitated by the Burgundians. His lands would seemingly be inherited by his own three sons, with the two remaining uncles offering to sponsor a coronation. Once these children were let out of the safe zones to meet their uncles, however, they would be ruthlessly put down by them, with only one child escaping into a quiet church life. The brothers' lands were then split between the three remaining sons of Clovis, one down. Despite this drama back home, the Burgundians would be conquered, and along with Provence to the south, all of former Gaul would now be under Frankish control. Meanwhile, on the plateau, the tribe of Thuringia would be conquered after insulting the honor of one of the sons. Following the expansion, however, that son would die. Clothar, one of the two remaining sons, would then make an attempt to partition the land, but be rebuffed by his brother and nephew, who had taken over. Despite this conflict, though, the nephew would also soon die, and the two sons would partition the land between them. Two down, one to go. Clothar would take this increased power base and use it to attempt expansion against the Saxons. While his back was turned, though, the other son would ally with Clothar's own child against him, launching a dual rebellion and invasion of Clothar's lands. This was the final confrontation, and a devastating civil war seemed to be on the horizon. Luckily for Clothar, however, his brother would suddenly die of dysentery, leaving him as the sole survivor and inheritor of all the lands of Clovis. Of course, he still had his own son rebelling against him. He would send his two other sons to deal with this issue, eventually strangling him and then burning his young family. The year was 560, 49 years after the death of Clovis. Clothar would die 1 year later, in 561, allegedly of overwhelming guilt at killing his own son and his family. His last act would be to split his united realm in four once again, giving each male heir a base of independent power. Thus ended round one, and started round two. As we can see from round one, the Frankish wars of division and unification would be times of uniquely strong brutality. Brothers would take turns allying with each other and turning on each other, with no mercy shown to their respective families. The call to conquest and embodying the strength of Clovis would imbue each leader with an overwhelming ambition, and the precedent set in this round of conflicts would legitimize brutality towards innocent family members in the future wars. As we also saw, though, the lands of Burgundy, Provence, and Thuringia would all be conquered by the Franks during this period of division. With unification as their united aim, it would be in the interest of the brothers to expand their own given power base as much as possible, so as to give them the best shot of ultimate victory. Because of this, the overall Frankish realm would continue to expand, with its internal economy and administration developed, even through the constant threat of civil war. Another thing to keep an eye on here would be the concessions each brother will have to make to their own internal factions, in order to maintain a strong front against the competition. Although the brothers and their retinues would be in constant conflict, the church was able to sit out the civil war, effectively continuing their administration of the united Frankish realm just as before. Cities and villages would develop and outlast the changes in borders. Local elites would rise to prominence, either economically or through the military campaigns, and pose their families as valuable allies who would need to be placated during their rapidly changing situations. All of this would contribute to a gradual change in the Frankish political formula. Each round would bring more of this change, though, and with that, it's time for round two, what I consider to be the most dramatic. The divisions following Clothar I's death would be as follows. His son, Chilperic, would take Soissons, encompassing much of modern Flanders. His son, Sigebert, would take Austrasia, the Frankish eastern lands on the plateau. His son, Guntram, would take Orléans, later known as Burgundy, a kingdom encompassing the southeastern highlands, from modern Switzerland to Provence, but including some of central France as well. The eldest son would take Paris, encompassing northern and western France. The eldest son would die quite soon after this succession, however, leaving his lands to be partitioned by Chilperic of Soissons and Guntram of Burgundy. Chilperic would combine Soissons and northern France from this partition to create the Kingdom of Neustria, one of the major realms of Europe for the next two centuries. The lands of Neustria and Austrasia represent the two rival bases of power within Frankish civilization, with Neustria representing the former Gallic stronghold of northern France and the River Seine, and Austrasia representing the Frankish base along the Rhine and Main rivers. These will be the main competitors. The lands of Aquitaine, Burgundy, and the Frankish tributaries of the plateau will act as periphery states, whose support or opposition can offer a key advantage to the competition. As it's always more interesting to pick a side in any conflict, we'll choose to follow Austrasia through the many years of civil war ahead. For round two, this puts us in camp with Sigebert. Sigebert would start this round strong with a marriage to a Visigothic princess named Brunhilde. Besides being a renowned beauty, their marriage would lead to an alliance between Austrasia and the Visigoths down in Spain, threatening both Guntram and Chilperic. In response, Chilperic would marry Brunhilde's sister, thus securing the Visigoths as allies of Neustria as well. While a good move on paper, this would quickly go downhill for Chilperic. Unlike the happy marriage and seemingly genuine relationship between Sigebert and Brunhilde, Chilperic and his wife would not get along at all, and he would soon invite back his mistresses, including a low-born girl named Friedegund. To make matters worse, the alliance with the Visigoths would soon break down with the death of their king, making the whole thing pointless from the view of Chilperic. So, encouraged by his mistress Friedegund, He would have his wife strangled and marry Fridigund herself shortly after. The assassination of Brunhilde's sister would create an instant blood feud between Brunhilde and Fridigund, who Brunhilde blamed for her sister's death. This feud would quickly spread to the two brothers, and soon Sigebert would demand justice. When this was denied, the men of Austrasia and Neustria would march to war. This civil war would prove to be especially brutal for all parties involved, and take many twists and turns in fortune. Guntram of Burgundy would first support Austrasia, before switching sides to support Neustria, before switching sides again back to Austrasia. Finally, in 575, Sigebert had gotten the upper hand, marching into Neustria almost unopposed to put an end to the war. However, while on the march, Fridigund would send two assassins armed with poisoned weapons to attack him. They would fail to kill him outright, but successfully poison him, with Sigebert dying shortly after, seemingly ending the civil war. However, unlike previous conflicts, the civil war did not end with the death of one of the brothers. The vassals and elites of Austrasia would rally around Sigebert's 5-year-old son and his mother Brunhilde, successfully preventing their lands from being partitioned by Neustria and Burgundy. This event did, however, lead to a small break in the conflict, as both sides recovered from the widespread devastation. Chilperic of Neustria would die 9 years later, in 584. Here too, the vassals and elites of Neustria would rally to maintain their status within the realm, not allowing the land to be partitioned. Fridigund would live on and successfully unify the Neustrian elites into supporting her son to be king at a mere 4 months old. Both Austrasia and Neustria would then submit to Burgundy as their kids grew into adults, but the blood feud between Brunhilde and Fridigund would continue to fester. When Guntram of Burgundy died in 592, Austrasia would inherit his lands, and Brunhilde would encourage her son to finally invade Fridigund's Neustria once more, setting off yet another civil war. This war would see the climactic battle described in the intro, with the army of Neustria choosing to mask itself with branches, just as Malcolm's army would against Shakespeare's Macbeth. This battle was also memorable for the actions of Fridigund, who would ride into the battle herself on horseback, with the 8-year-old king sitting on her lap the whole time. The Austrasian Burgundians would be forced to retreat, and Brunhilde's son would be murdered soon after, leaving his own 2 infant children to rule Austrasia and Burgundy respectively. Fridigund would die shortly after, however, and with her death, Brunhilde was now the only combatant left standing of the original blood feud that started this mess, but she still would not leave the job unfinished. As the effective regent while her 2 infant grandchildren ruled, she would choose to continue the civil war, beating Neustria into a small and impoverished realm on the edge of Francia by the early 600s. And so, round 2 would seemingly come to an end, with the victorious Brunhilde securing her line's prominence in Francia. It would seem so, but under the surface, factors had been changing. The largely Germanic elite in Austrasia would begin to conflict with the largely Gallo-Roman elite in Burgundy, largely over the issue of Brunhilde, the old woman who held the entire civilization in the palm of her hands. Whereas in another time, a Merovingian king would have calmed these rebellious elites down through gifts, military force, or shared conquest, the kings of Austrasia and Burgundy were still too young to rally the nobles in any way. So, Brunhilde, desperate to hold on to her power, would convince her young grandson in Burgundy that her other grandson in Austrasia was actually an illegitimate son of a gardener, telling him it was only right that he should rule both kingdoms to fix this. Brunhilde's Burgundian grandson was convinced, and the two victorious powers would go to war once more in 612, with Burgundy emerging victorious, and its king mercilessly murdering his Austrasian brother, so as to unite their realms. Unfortunately, however, for this ruthless new king of Austrasia-Burgundy, dysentery would strike again soon after, with him following his murdered brother to the grave merely 1 year later, in 613. With this, the throne would pass yet again to an infant, Brunhilde's great-grandchild. This time, however, the nobles of Austrasia were not content to allow Brunhilde to rule over them once again, and would openly revolt against her, inviting the Dark Horse candidate, Fridigun's son, Clothar II, to sweep in from the diminished Neustria. Clothar II would accept, defeating Brunhilde in a civil war after most of her army defected. Following this, he would massacre all of Brunhilde's great-grandchildren, before ruthlessly torturing the old lady and having her torn apart by multiple horses. With that disturbing end, round two would go to Fridigund, with her son subjugating Austrasia into a united Francia once more. So let's unpack what just happened in round two, and see if we can filter out some of the important changes from the first round. As in the first round, the division of the wider confederation would lead to a focus on local development for each brother's realms. Unlike last time, this round would see the introduction of the Justinian Plague, and the full extents of the decline of Mediterranean trade and the threatening of the church in Rome. These developments, in addition to the brutal civil wars, meant that the Frankish leaders would not be able to rule off of using their own resources alone. They would have to focus on building up new ones, and creating a harmonious social hierarchy that could support them. They and the women who ruled in their name would patronize the expansion of the church throughout their lands, supporting the development of infrastructure, and make concessions to powerful elites who held influence among the population centers. The major change in this second round would be this last point, as the period between 570 and 640 would see a massive expansion in the power of the Frankish aristocracy. The multiple child rulers and queen regents would force the central leadership to outsource many of their authorities to locals in order to prevent them from revolting and gain their favor for the sake of defense. Those who survived these brutal and fratricidal civil wars were men of merit, who possessed the ability to build strong bases of power for themselves even through the mud and fog of combat. With the aristocracy's rise to prominence, they would begin to flex their strength. Whereas the death of a brother would mean instant partition through most of the 6th century, the aristocracy would be quick to rally to protect their sovereignty in later conflicts, at the very least demanding concessions of any incoming ruler. They would also begin to impose limitations and challenges within their own realm, with the best example being the division of the more Germanic aristocracy of Austrasia from the more Latinized aristocracy of Burgundy, Aquitaine, and to a lesser extent Neustria. These aristocrats would emphasize different precedents and traditions as being more important, thus leading to the creation of unique regional identities across the Frankish realms. The unified rule of Clothar II would continue this trend in the early 600s, as the aristocrats of Austrasia had won him the civil war through their betrayal of Brunhilde. Clothar would wipe all edicts of Brunhilde made in Burgundy and Austrasia, labeling them as criminal acts of a woman who had murdered many Merovingian princes. In their place, he would create a new social and political order, developing formal relationships with both the church and the aristocracy at the Council of Paris in 614. Out of this council would come the elevation of local execution of laws, protecting regions from interference both by other regions and by the central government itself. He would also establish a permanent court within Neustria, formalizing the king's presence as an institution, rather than participating in the traveling warband court of before. This act would both increase the formality of relationships and allow the king to keep an eye on his aristocrats, while also better facilitating aristocrats to come together and form internal factions within the realm. Perhaps the most influential aspect of this aristocratic rise was the movement by the influential elites Pepin of Landen and Arnulf of Metz to grant Austrasia autonomy from the rest of the Frankish realm. They would rally the Austrasian elites together to create a dangerous revolt, thus forcing Clothar II to grant Austrasia autonomy. It would become a semi-independent kingdom under the rule of his son, Dagobert I. Unlike other divisions, this one was made while the king was still alive, which helped to formalize the borders of Austrasia from those of Neustria and the other Frankish realms. Clothar would die in the 620s, leading to a brief period of divided rule once more, before Dagobert's brother retired to a monastery. This would leave Dagobert I as the leader of a united Francia once more. Although an effective leader who led the Franks into the height of their power under the Merovingians, Dagobert would also have to adapt to the new political realities. After the revolt of Samo, which we talked about last episode, Dagobert would lead an invasion towards his lands in Carpathia and the Plateau. Here, despite his powerful position, the Franks would be defeated by the Slavs, opening Austrasia up to extensive raiding from the Sorbs and other tribes. This would prove to be fatal to Dagobert's reputation within the Austrasian aristocracy, and they would threaten him once more with large-scale revolts unless autonomy was granted. Dagobert would fold just as his father did, granting Austrasia semi-independence once more from the rest of the Frankish realm, this time under his 3-year-old son. The emergence of an infant as the leader of a semi-independent kingdom would serve to fully cement the aristocracy as the ascendant power in Austrasia, which was quickly becoming the primary base of power for the Frankish civilization as a whole. In fact, the twin power of the church and aristocracy would soon come to eclipse the Merovingian kings completely. Future leaders would take the role of symbolic figureheads only, serving to unite the realm under one identity, but not having any power at all outside of this. They would be known from now as do-nothing kings. Administration would instead largely come under the role of the mayordomo, or leader of the house. This was an originally minor position dating back to Roman times, where they would serve as personal administrators to the magnate's palace. During the times of concessions in the early 6th century, they would become lead political administrators for the kings, where they would formally represent the king in managing relationships with their appointed vassals, and seeing to the partitions and executions of land distribution. The reforms of Clothar II and Dagobert in the early 7th century, meanwhile, would bring dramatically more influence to this position, with lifetime assignments being granted, and the localization of administration to static regions and cities. Their job was also made much more efficient by the establishment of capitals, Paris for Neustria and Metz for Austrasia. All of these changes made the role of managing vassal relationships very important, as they were able to personally build their own relationships and distribute land to key allies. All they needed was a moment of weakness by the kings to seize power completely, and with the frequent child rulers, this opportunity was taken. Future kings would remain important culturally, though even here they would be outcompeted by the church. Ultimately, the control and nature of land distribution would be the primary factor enabling the rise of the aristocracy, the church, and the mayordomos. In any agrarian society, land is the basis for long-term stability and power. Through the land, food is grown, resources are harvested, and institutions are built. Though fortunes may change quickly, control of the land ensures a base of support one can fall back on. In addition to this, land can be developed through generations, through political changes, through anything with careful stewardship and proper defense. As this land is developed, it will bring with it procedural knowledge, foundations of local culture, and traditions of responsibility, all of which will allow strong and independent bases for whoever owns them. But given the many complicated roles people play in society and the unequal nature of land's resources, how is it decided who owns the land? The answer to this question is a society's land distribution, and it varies widely. So who owns the land at this point in the Frankish civilization? We can answer this by starting from the situation in the early 6th century. At the time, manorialism still dominated. Most land was held by large landowners who had grown prosperous from the social consolidation and monetary commerce of Rome from centuries prior. The land was worked by laborers, dependent on the magnate for patronage and compensation. With the large decline taking place over the course of the 6th century, the economy sustaining this commercialism would collapse, and owning land would become more dangerous. There is archaeological evidence of wider spread manor-based ownership being abandoned in favor of community-style living during this time. Populations would choose to live in villages for their own protection, trading interstate commerce for self-sufficiency. Here, the villages themselves owned the land, giving families the ability to work it based on their reputation and position in the social hierarchy. Thus, the best way to get ahead would be to improve your standing with your locality. From a state point of view, this meant that borders didn't matter so much as influence over the populations themselves, with the space between them being rather ambiguous. Importantly, large-scale divisions of land outside of the top independent realm were not hereditary at this point. Military and church administration were both appointed through the ducts, comes, bishops, and priesthoods. Because of both of these factors, the appointed leaders, while technically having authority over the land, would only gain ownership through either extortion in the case of a duct and his retinue, or more reliably by building up local relationships. Over time, this would lead to donations of land for these appointed administrators, a concept which would eventually evolve into proto-fiefs, as certain segments of land would be put aside by a region for those carrying the appropriate social status. Thus, new appointees would come into a pre-made base of local power, which their predecessors had been able to build up during times of weaker central control. Donations were also done this way for monasteries throughout the plateau, as missionaries worked to convert and tend to the local populations. Building social status to the point of being a candidate to be appointed to these positions, meanwhile, was its own process. It normally meant either providing a service to the leader of someone of higher social standing, or allying with the more illustrious families. This would lead to the rise of dynastic importance within the growing aristocracy. Because of the fundamental importance of land, knowing the land distribution is a key to understanding any group of people, as it will be a microcosm of their overarching culture and development. In this way, it forms a central pillar of a state's political formula, or its special combination that's used to justify the ruling minority's right to govern. A political formula both defines how a state is organized from the top down, but also how its constituents buy into it from the bottom up. We will talk about it more another time, but what's important to know for now is that the change in land distribution would signal a change in the political formula for the Franks. The formula in the times of the early Franks was tribal in nature, relying on a leader with a strong reputation to travel through his lands, winning battles and loot for his followers, and subjugating their enemies. Loyal followers were then appointed to administer the conquest and extract resources from the local populations. This formula had changed over the course of the 6th and 7th centuries to be one whose organization relied much more on building relationships with the existing institutions and populations of the land, through both the aristocracy and the church. Legitimacy, meanwhile, was tied to Merovingian blood itself, imbued with the mythical flame of its founders. This situation would persist through the 7th and early 8th centuries, through two more rounds of Frankish fragmentation and reunification. Even with the mayordomos replacing the Merovingians as leaders of the state organization, they cannot yet find a better way to source their legitimacy, which was needed for that all-important second aspect to the political formula, how its constituents buy into the state from the bottom up. To discard the Merovingians prematurely would have invited outrage and revolt from elites across the realm. This status quo would change with the emergence of the Carolingians as hereditary mayordomos of Austrasia in the early 700s. The Carolingians, formerly known as Arnulfings, would actually be descended from that group of nobles that forced Clothar II and Dagobert to grant Austrasia autonomy way back in the early 7th century. Arnulf of Metz and Pepin of Landen would form a formal alliance through marrying together their children, thus forming the Arnulfing line. They would remain prominent through the rounds of the 7th century, but solidify power in Austrasia by the early 8th. Into this situation of non-royal institutions running administration, but legitimacy still tied to the mythical Merovingians, would step Charles Martel, or Charles the Hammer. He would lead the Austrasians as mayordomo to reunify the Kingdom of the Franks, defeating Neustria and Burgundy in a series of campaigns. With that, this round of civil war would be over relatively quickly, and Charles would look to strengthen his dynasty's claim on the Franks more permanently. To do this, he would need to create an alternate source of legitimacy, in essence, modifying the political formula to better match the new organization of the kingdom. He would start this change through a powerful tool, external expansion. The Franks at this time were very divided internally, with each major division having its own entrenched nobility who had grown used to autonomy. Spending time facing a common enemy would allow these wounds to heal, while glory and prestige gained from the conquests would help to build legitimacy in the same way Clovis had centuries before. Unfortunately for the independent states of the plateau, the target of Charles' expansions would be aimed in their direction. Since the initial Frankish dominance in the 6th century, the German tribal confederations had slipped from direct subjects to tributaries and eventually to near independence. Charles would begin the Frankish march east once more, launching campaigns on the plateau against Alemannia and Bavaria. The real key to building the new political formula, though, would come from the rising Umayyad Caliphate to the south. Over the past century, Islam had risen from its obscure origins to conquer all across North Africa, eventually even crossing Gibraltar and taking the vast majority of Iberia. By the 720s, the Muslims stretched all the way to the Pyrenees and had begun launching raids into southern France with mixed success. Charles would take the opportunity to expand into Aquitaine, which had also strayed into independence. Charles would subjugate them, thus taking the role of frontline defender of Christianity in the process. The Umayyads would test this new competitor at the Battle of Tours in 732, in which a sizable party was defeated by a combined Frankish force led by Charles himself. Although not an ultra-climactic battle in and of itself, the Battle of Tours would symbolize the furthest extent of Islamic conquest in Western Europe, and proved to be extremely important in the eyes of Christianity. With this, Charles and his line would see the solution to their issue of the defunct Merovingian political formula. They would present themselves and their state, by extension, as the very sword of Christianity in the West, protecting and expanding their realm against pagans and Muslims alike. The Battle of Tours would be very helpful for this aim, serving as the prime example of Charles turning this idea into a reality. Church and aristocratic elites would stop following him because they had to, and instead follow him because they truly believed his right to govern. He would also begin to form intimate bonds with the organized church, helping figures such as Saint Bonifaci to reform the Frankish church, which had grown extremely independent and variable in its practices, through its isolation and scattered monasteries. A major step towards organizing the church in inner Europe would be Charles' appointment of Saint Bonifaci as Archbishop of all of Germany east of the Rhine, from his seat at the city of Mainz. Here, he would work to discipline the clergy and form a stronger church focused on converting the pagans around them. Charles would die in 741, his name giving birth to the Carolingian dynasty. He would divide his united lands between his two sons, though his sons would cooperate for the moment due to extensive revolts breaking out across the land. This would be the test of the new political formula, as those most accustomed to independence rebelled against the Carolingian right to rule. Aquitaine, Alemannia, and the Bavarians would all launch wars against the new mayordomos, and all three would be defeated. Carloman, the eldest son, would infamously invite thousands of Alemannia elites to a council in 746 after defeating them in battle. Here, he would ruthlessly execute every one in a move of extreme treachery, an event referred to as the Blood Court of Cronstadt. This would completely behead the Alemanni as any semi-independent force, granting the Franks direct control of their lands. Following this, Carloman would retire to a monastery to atone for his actions, focusing on piety for the rest of his life. This action would leave the entire united Frankish realm to Pippin the Short, Charles's other son. Pippin would take the loose ends of foreign conquests and protector Christendom and tie them together through his reign. In 751, he would formally question Pope Zachary if it was right that the Merovingians should rule while having no formal power, at which point Pope Zachary would grant permission for the Carolingians to usurp the Merovingian line. This Pippin would do in 751, in a ceremony with the support of his nobles, army, and church. In Italy, the popes, previously under Byzantine protection, had found themselves in a very tough spot. The Lombards of North Italy stood in a position to dominate the Exarchate of Ravenna, the final Byzantine stronghold in the north, and now threatened Rome itself. This, combined with a weakening of Byzantium due to endless wars with the Arabs, and a distancing with them due to the issue of iconoclasm, which the popes disapproved of vehemently. When the Lombards eventually captured Ravenna and advanced on Rome, Pope Stephen II would travel himself to Soissons, where he personally anointed Pippin with oil, formally affirming kingship for him and his heirs. He did this in return for Pippin's protection, an arrangement which suited them both quite well. Pippin would promise to return Ravenna and other lands of the Byzantine Exarchate, giving those lands exclusively to the Pope under his own secular authority, so that he may protect his church from the hostile forces on the peninsula. This would become known as the Donations of Pippin, a treaty that would guarantee the lands of the Papal States for the following centuries. In addition to this would be the introduction of a document known as the Donation of Constantine, in which Constantine I of the Roman Empire bequeathed all political power to the Pope in Rome, at which point the Pope would generously allow Constantine to continue ruling under the Pope's lease. This concept would eventually lead to the idea of papal supremacy over all states of Christendom, directly conflicting with the Frankish formula of Carolingian protectorship over all the states of Christendom. Though the popes and the Franks were in a position where they needed each other at the moment, this would plant the seeds for a tremendous conflict in medieval Europe. But, to end things off for today, Pippin would follow through in his own donations, launching two wars against the Lombards to shatter their power and force them to give the lands of the Exarchate back to the papacy. After further campaigns to cement the new Carolingian political formula, he would die in 768, dividing the Frankish realm once again between his two sons. This round, however, like the two before it, would end very quickly when one son died only 3 years later in 771, leaving the entire Frankish realm to one man, now known as Charles, but later to be known as Charles the Great, Charlemagne. Charlemagne would take to heart the Carolingian political formula, strengthening it into a personal iron legitimacy by both reforming and strengthening his church and state from within, and expanding it outside. This role would be embodied by his large-scale attack towards the Lombards in 774, in which he would shatter the balance of power in Europe by not only defeating them, but conquering them completely, folding northern Italy in as another kingdom in his realm. This action would indeed almost fully unify Christendom outside of the Byzantine Empire, and Charlemagne was now fully ready to aim this power towards the stubborn pagans of inner Europe. Thank you for listening to Between the Seas. We covered a large amount of history this series. The foundations set up by Frankish state building, the church expansions and initial reforms, and the cementing of cultures in the East that will define our story for hundreds of years to come. But I hope you enjoyed this brief overview. Next time, we will introduce our next trilogy, which will be on the rise and fall of the Carolingians, and what ripple effects their imperial pretensions would have on Inner Europe. Until then, this has been Jacob, and I hope that your family gets along better than the Merovingians.